News, I'm Tom McNeil. Four members of the Chinese military have been charged with hacking into the credit reporting agency Equifax and getting personal information for nearly half of all Americans back in 2017. AP correspondent Julie Walker.
Attorney General William Barr says China is consistently stealing from the U.S., whether it's technology, trade secrets, or something else.
For years, we have witnessed China's voracious appetite for the personal data of Americans.
The hackers are part of the People's Liberation Army, an arm of the Chinese military. FBI Deputy Director David Bowditch acknowledges there's little chance of them coming to the U.S. for trial.
But one day, these criminals will slip up, and when they do, we'll be there.
The hackers got names, birth dates, and social security numbers of nearly 150 million Americans and driver's licenses of about 10 million. I'm Julie Walker.
China's Hubei province reported another 103 deaths from coronavirus on Monday, pushing the death toll past 1,000. Chinese officials say there are now nearly 43,000 confirmed cases of coronavirus across the country. VOA's Marissa Melton.
Britain declared the virus a serious and imminent threat to public health after reporting four new cases on Monday, bringing the number of confirmed British cases to eight. Health Minister Matt Hancock's declaration gives the government more power to isolate people to keep the virus from spreading. The center of the outbreak is China's Hubei province, where millions remain under lockdown and people are complaining of food shortages. China's central bank is making $43 billion available to help businesses involved in fighting the epidemic. Health experts say the spread may ease in warm weather when people get out of doors and are not in such close contact with each other. But this is a new strain of coronavirus, and some of the experts believe it is too soon to say if spring and summer will kill it off. Marissa Melton, VOA News.
And this is VOA News. Top U.S. Democratic presidential candidates are spending a final day sparring with each other ahead of Tuesday's crucial party primary in New Hampshire, trying to gain an early advantage in the race to oppose Republican President Donald Trump in next November's national election. The contest in the rural northeastern state has taken an added consequence in the aftermath of a split vote in last week's Iowa caucuses. They were remembered mostly for the agonizingly slow release of the final outcome that was linked to a wrongly coded app used in collecting vote totals from throughout the farm state. In the end, former South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg edged Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders as a self-declared Democratic Socialist. U.S. President Donald Trump's administration is proposing a steep 21% cut in aid in the United States and what it provides to foreign countries, with a budget request of $44.1 billion for programs. That's compared with $55.7 billion enacted in fiscal 2020. VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman.
The acting director of the Office of Management and Budget at the White House, Russ Vogt, says it's time for the United States to rethink how it does foreign aid.
We need to move beyond the reality of spending money for the Bob Dylan statue in Mozambique, or the NASA space camp in Pakistan, or the Professional Cricket League in Afghanistan.
The president's budget needs to be approved by lawmakers. The chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Elliot Engel, tweeted a photo of a trash receptacle, indicating the expected destination for the spending proposals when they arrive on Capitol Hill. Steve Herman, VOA News, at the White House.
U.S. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer asked the State Department watchdog on Monday to investigate what he said was shameful and illegal retaliation by President Trump against a witness who testified against him at last year's impeachment hearings. Schumer asked 74 inspector generals throughout the government to probe any retaliation against federal workers who report Trump administration misconduct, but singled out the president's dismissal of Army Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman. As a Ukraine expert at the National Security Council in the White House, Vindman testified against Mr. Trump at House of Representatives impeachment hearings leading up to approval of two articles of impeachment, although Mr. Trump last week was acquitted after a three-week trial in the Senate. A Russian court has handed down sentences ranging from 6 to 18 years to a group of young leftist activists accused of running an underground terrorist network, the latest chapter in a controversial case marred by allegations that evidence was fabricated or gained through torture by the country's federal security services. I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 11th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South Sudan's SPLM-IO says it is disappointed by the Juba government's rejection of a proposed 23-state solution.
The people of South Sudan, they need peace. And the government, particularly President Salva, has to commit himself to implement this agreement.
Flight suspensions from China due to coronavirus are impacting Chinese imports to East African markets. The Liberian editor writes an open letter to Facebook chief executive Mark Zuckerberg. The Gambian government shuts down a Belgian company for tax evasion, and that Malawi's Human Rights Defenders Coalition plans to shut down the offices of the Electoral Commission.
We need a new mix to be at the Electoral Commission so that they can start working on the electoral calendar and electoral logistics. So we think Jen Ansah is actually wasting the people's time by insisting to be at the Electoral Commission.
Timothy Mtambo is the chair of the Human Rights Defenders Coalition of Malawi, and Human Rights Watch releases a new report detailing abuses in Mali. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Regional leaders from the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, also known as IGAD, have held consultations with South Sudanese President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Dr. Riek Machar on the sidelines of the African Union Summit in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. The discussions focused on resolving issues that are impeding implementation of the peace agreement, including the number of states and their boundaries, as well as the implementation of security arrangements. Baluanga, the Director for Information and Public Relations of the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition, says the group is disappointed but not surprised by Juba government's rejection of a proposed 23-state solution.
To us, this is a major breakthrough. If President Salva did not have a change of heart of what he has agreed upon here in Addis Ababa, because the people of South Sudan, they need peace. And the government, particularly President Salva, has to commit himself to implement this agreement, because this is not the first time for them, you know, to walk out from the agreement or to neglect any issue that's been agreed upon by the South Sudanese parties and between him and the first vice president designated, Dr. Riek Machar. We're optimistic that the coming meeting will resolve all the outstanding critical issues if the government has averted from maintaining the barbaric status quo that they're seeking, to maintain in our country, and if they have a political will to implement this agreement in letter and spirit.
So based on the agreement that you have at the moment in Addis Ababa, are you confident that all these issues could be resolved within 2 weeks so a transitional government could be formed? Because, as you know, the 100-day extension period of the pre-transitional period ends in less than 2 weeks.
We recognize that now the end of 100 days is approaching, and as little has been achieved. But we think that the next meeting, if it went well, we will resolve all these issues. Now we are halfway to resolve the issue of the states, remaining now the issue of the security arrangements. We believe that with the help of the UN mission in South Sudan, we can make use of the little time that we have, at least to deploy the forces in the major towns, and for the government to withdraw their forces from the civilian centers and in the major towns in our country. But I think that now the move itself, or this meeting, it's an achievement itself. But what now, we're waiting for that, if the meeting will bear fruits, and we hopefully think it will, because for our part, the SPLM-IO, we will do anything that to achieve or to resolve this issue so that we can have a lasting peace in our country.
Paul Both Baluang is the spokesperson for the Sudan People's Liberation Movement in opposition. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa. Malawi's Human Rights Defenders Coalition, the HRDC, says it plans to shut down the offices of the Electoral Commission if its chairperson and other commissioners fail to resign. HRDC chairperson Timothy Mtambo says the Constitutional Court's ruling earlier this month is a strong indication that Election Commission Chair Justice Jean Ansa and her commissioners failed to organize free, fair, and credible polls during the May 21, 2019 presidential elections. Both the Electoral Commission and the ruling Democratic Progressive Party are appealing the judgment of the Constitutional Court. Mtambo tells viewers Peter Clotty that it is unfortunate that the chairperson of the commission is refusing to step down.
Landmark judgment, the Constitutional Court actually vindicated us and vindicated the citizens of our country that she managed a fraudulent and a messed up electoral process. And we think she doesn't even deserve to stay in that office because she has completely lost the public trust. So her failure to resign is actually delaying a lot of processes. So the challenge is Jean Ansa and her fellow commissioners, who we do not trust, continues being at the Electoral Commission. They will delay the electoral preparation. We need a new make to be at the Electoral Commission so that they can start working on the electoral calendar, electoral budget, and electoral logistics. So we think Jean Ansa is actually wasting the people's time by insisting to be at the Electoral Commission.
She has said, as you rightly put it, that she was going to retire after the judgment. Why don't you allow the process to go on since the Malawi Electoral Commission and the ruling party are challenging the Constitutional Court judgment?
Actually, we said these are matters of trust. All across the country, when that judgment was given, all the people across the country celebrated. That meant justice was delivered and the people of this country were happy. And yet she wants to be appealing against the same people. So we think she's not doing it in good faith and we do not want her to continue wasting our time.
If the commissioners, including the chairperson, Madam Justice Jean Ansa, don't step down as you have demanded she does and her commissioners do immediately, what steps will the HRDC take?
Actually, we won't stop demonstrating. Actually, this time around, we are going to Malawi Electoral Commission. We have never gone to their offices ever since we started demonstrating. So this Thursday, we are going to Malawi Electoral Commission, and we are going to shut down the Malawi Electoral Commission. And when we shut down the Malawi Electoral Commission, she and her fellow commissioners will not operate. So we are not going to stop at anything, but we are going to make sure that Jean Ansa and her fellow commissioners must vacate our electoral commission so that competent people and people of integrity can go and run our show.
Timothy Mtambo is the head of the Malawi Human Rights Defenders Coalition. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotty from the capital, Lilongwe. With the coronavirus continuing to spread in China, its economic impact is already being felt in East African markets, cut off from their Chinese suppliers. VOA Swahili service reporter Eid Iwusu and Herbert Abdi have this story as narrated by Scott Stearns.
Commerce between China and East African markets has grown steadily over the last few years, with both bulk and small-scale traders importing lower-cost Chinese goods. But the outbreak of the coronavirus and the suspension of East African flights to China means fewer Chinese goods to sell. Alida Wanjiru is a second-hand clothes dealer in Nairobi.
Coronavirus has greatly affected our business. I used to travel every 2 months to bring goods from China, but now we have been told not to travel and wait until further instructions. It's affecting us a lot. Customers come and fail to get what they want. On the other hand, we have to pay bills.
It's the same story in Tanzania, where business owners in Dar es Salaam's Kariakou market say they're running out of merchandise from China. Andrea Richard is a used shoe seller.
It has affected us a lot. We could get goods to sell from China every 2 months. It's impossible to do that right now because we cannot travel to China. We have no option but to follow measures in place by authorities to avoid the spread of the coronavirus. We have to wait until they allow us to travel.
Samora Machel is managing director of the Kenyan Chamber of Commerce.
The first group of people to directly feel this pain are small scale traders, especially youths like those in Majengo Market, Kongowe Market, whose retail goods are imported from China weekly. They will not survive.
With Kenya Airways and Air Tanzania suspending flights to China because of the virus, East African tourism officials are hoping the disruption in air traffic does not undercut regional tourism revenues, as it is already being felt in local markets. Scott Stearns, VOA News, for Idu Weso and Huba Abdi in Dar es Salaam and Nairobi.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February 11th. Daybreak Africa time is now 16 minutes past the hour. A report released this week by the U.S.-based RAND Corporation says there will not be any visible reforms in Zimbabwe in the next few years, as the old guard and military are still firmly in control, more than 2 years after the late President Robert Mugabe was toppled in a de facto coup d'etat. According to the report, which was based on dozens of interviews last year in Zimbabwe, although President Mnangagwa has deployed flowery reform rhetoric, his administration's piecemeal actions belie any movement towards genuine political or economic reform. ZANU-PF Central Committee member Joseph Schumer says the RAND Corporation's report is not surprising.
This is an institution that is in America that is obviously pushing for a certain agenda, and definitely what they will have to put across to all of us is a gloom picture that they are painting, a picture that they really work so hard to make sure that it happens here in Zimbabwe, which is very, very unfortunate, because we all know that obviously it's not going to be an easy walk in the park as long as we don't have a investment from all these sectors like the IMF, the World Bank, and all the other international players in resuscitating our economy. So as long as they are preaching that gospel, they are actually striking fear into the hearts of every other sector that is supposed to come in and help Zimbabwe to come up. That is very unfortunate, and the most unfortunate part is that it comes from an institution that is based in America, and you wonder why they actually do that.
They are also indicating that with the old guard and military still firmly in power, both benefiting from patches atop the highly patronage-based economy. So genuine reform is unlikely in the next 1 to 3 years under the present conditions in Zimbabwe. Do you agree with that?
The military basically went back to barracks, after the operation that they come up with, that they called Operation Restore Legacy. And we all know, we used to see them every day on our streets, at roadblocks and several other places. We no longer see them now. We know that all the institutions that are supposed to be running their affairs are the ones that are now taking care of that. We know that the police have come back to do their constitutional order of making sure they maintain peace and order at all given time. We don't see the military anymore, in that the military has gone back to its barracks. For anybody to say the military is still out there and in control is definitely a fallacy. Yes, the military is going to be there because constitutionally they've got a certain mandate that they're supposed to carry out. But to say that they are in charge is definitely myopic and to me, it's far-fetched.
Joseph Schumer is ZANU-PF's Central Committee member. He spoke from Bulawayo with Gibbs Dube of VOA Zimbabwe Service. This past year was the deadliest for civilians in Mali since the political and military crisis erupted there in 2012, says Corinne Dufka, West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. A new report by Human Rights Watch details atrocities in Mali, especially the central part of the country. Dufka tells Ricky Shryak the report is based on the accounts of dozens of witnesses.
The violence is underscored by an ethnic dynamic. The Islamists have since at least 2015 concentrated their recruitment on the nomadic Pul or Fulani, who have in many instances attacked agrarian communities, including the Dogon and the Bambara. So the Dogon and the Bambara organize self-defense groups to protect their communities, but these groups have actually gone on the rampage against entire Pul communities, who they have really blamed collectively for their perceived support of the Islamists. Islamists.
What's your reaction in light of all of this, in light of all of your research, to kind of the recent news that the UN top humanitarian official has, you know, urged more engagement with armed groups and more aid and development funding as a way to stabilize the country?
Well, the violence by the armed Islamist groups as well as by the civil defense militias has really provoked a humanitarian crisis of, you know, tremendous proportion. I mean, there have been tens of thousands of people displaced as these villages have been burned and attacked. And then as it's been impossible for the civilians to earn a livelihood, you know, the Islamists have threatened agrarian communities, so they've been unable to plant and harvest their crops. And then the militias have also made it difficult for the poll to be able to move their animals from place to place. So, you know, the violence, it's, not only are people being massacred and taken off of public transportation vehicles, but it's become nearly impossible for them to sustain themselves and their families. We don't take a position on negotiations, but, you know, there really needs to be much more attention to ensure accountability for these atrocities. You know, I've been documenting these atrocities since 2015, but they have increased exponentially, especially in 2018 and 2019. And there have been scant investigations and trials of those responsible. So this has really led to and encouraged and emboldened these armed groups to continue to kill and maim civilians.
I know in your report you said in 2019 there were several investigations and 45 people were convicted. How does this scale up to the amount of violence that is happening? And how can the Malian government, with the resources it has, address these killings?
Yeah, the Malian government has in many ways favored a reconciliation approach, that is to bring the armed groups together and try to get them to commit to ceasefires and to, you know, respecting the lives of each other. But
Corinne Dufka is West Africa Director at Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Washington, D.C. Liberian journalist Rodney Sia, editor and publisher of Front Page Africa newspaper, has written an open letter to Facebook Chief Executive Officer Mark Zuckerberg to let him know that his Facebook has become the place where followers of the powers that be have become the known rebels in Liberia, using the social media platform to point out perceived enemies of the government. Sears says he was motivated to write the letter because two young Liberian women who recently lost their government jobs because someone accused them of being anti-George Weah government on the social media.
Since the end of the war, there seems to be a lot of tension going on in the country, especially regarding issues of Facebook. People are using now Facebook to create fake pages and attack each other. It's not so much about the freedom of expression, but personally going after people with insults, threats on people's lives and things like that, which is making the country to be in a very difficult position in terms of how we proceed to reconcile Liberia after the war.
Can you point to one or two examples of the dangers of Facebook that you're expressing in your letter?
Well, Jim, in the last 72 hours, a mother of two or three children lost her job from the Ministry of Gender because someone was not happy with her on Facebook and reported her to her bosses at the Ministry of Gender. And that lady lost her job just because she was on Facebook expressing her views against the George Weah government. Just last year, another lady was also in similar position. She was sitting in a crowd of people listening to the Henry Costa morning show and laughing at some of the things that were being said. Someone from the crowd went and pointed her out, and she was dismissed from a job at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So we've seen this pattern happen over and over again. It's like during the Civil War when people were standing in line as refugees and were being pointed out by people saying they were belonging to one tribe or one government or whatever or another. And the same thing is happening now on Facebook. They're using this Facebook now to go after perceived critics of the government, people who they feel are saying things against the government, and they're pointing them out. And that's the motivation for this letter for Facebook.
What do you think, Rodney, what should be the end result of your letter? What do you think Mark Zuckerberg can do?
Well, I'm hoping that Facebook can look at how they can, you know, curb the number of threats. I mean, expressing one's opinion or one's view is one thing, but when you go to the extreme of telling the government that principal X, Y, or Z is saying something bad about the government, so that as a result they should lose their jobs, that puts it in a very difficult position. And it makes it look like as if Liberians are no longer free to use the medium and social media to express themselves. And we're in a very polarized political environment. And it is important that all Liberians, you know, realize that whatever they do comes back to haunt people. The same circle of pointing people out against things that happen in society, these are things that cause the war in Liberia. And if we don't put a check on it now, we may find ourselves in a very, very serious predicament.
That was Rodney Sear, editor and publisher of Liberia's Front Page Africa newspaper. He was speaking with us from the Gambian capital, Banjul. The Gambian government on Monday shut down a Belgian company which has been contracted to provide national documents to the country after accusing the company of tax evasion. The Gambian National Administration says Simlex owes government 2 years tax arrears, and it is now asking to close the company to settle its back taxes. Pandero Mbai reports from Raleigh, North Carolina.
Yankuba Dabo is the Director General of Gambia's Revenue Authority. Dabo convened a press conference on Monday to shed light on the circumstances surrounding the closure of Semlex, a Belgian biometric company.
We came to the closure, temporal closure of Simlex today after allowing them to operate close to 2 years. As you know, every country has rules and regulation, processes and procedures to establish a business.
Dabo says Simlex has not been paying taxes for the past 2 years. He adds that despite repeated demands for the Belgian company to pay its fair share to the state, the company wouldn't pay its back taxes. Now the government has decided to compel Semblex to pay taxes it owed to the state.
As far as we are concerned, we have followed the law to the last point we can go in allowing them to operate for more than 1 year without them paying their taxes. And now we've got to a point where we said, now you have to pay. If you don't pay, we take action. And it is not about Simlex alone. This is what we do with all the other businesses. We will deal with you according to the law.
Simlex has been contracted to issue national identity cards and driver's licenses to Gambians. The company's operations have been halted for now, pending the settlement of its back taxes. Yankuba Dabo again.
When they started operating barely 2 years ago, we allowed them to operate based on the information that they gave us, that they will be working on having a tax exemption. We refer to it as SIC, Special Investment Certificate. And based on that information, we allowed them to operate for a six-month period, and we didn't see the certificate, and they were not forthcoming.
Dabo has debunked claims that Simlex has been granted tax exemption by the state. He says he is not aware of any such tax exemption. Ibu Jallo is a Gambian security analyst. Jallo is concerned about the safety of customers' data.
Simlex is a rootless company. They have a record of working with, you know, very poor countries, and they have so many ways and means of really screwing up the government. They have access to all this data.
Simlex had a rough pass with the former Jammeh administration. The former government had terminated the contract is signed with the company. The contract was subsequently renewed when the Barrow government came to power. There was no formal tender process that would allow other companies to bid for the contract. A local Gambian biometric company, Pristine, was interested in the contract, but the company felt being sidelined by the government. For VOA Daybreak Africa, this is Pandurim by reporting from Raleigh, North Carolina.
And that's it for this Tuesday, February 11th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga, host of VOA's Reporters Roundtable. Join us every Thursday as we discuss important African topics and events. I'll have a panel of African journalists and expert guests to discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. That's Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hey,
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.